And I was the first one to land an airplane on the leper settlement in on the island of Molokai. And of course, they, when I was flying to the other islands, I would always pass Molokai, and I would throw newspapers to the lepers, because they would only get information by radio or by newspapers once every 3 months, or every 3 weeks, I should say.
A lot of people didn't realize how isolated they were. What? They were isolated. That
oh, they're completely isolated, yes. Yeah. And so they were really fond of airplanes. And so they decided that since that I was dropping newspapers to them, they would like to see the airplane land there. So they had level planes flying below this big cliff. See, so they went and they landed, and so they could observe the airplane at close range. But they wouldn't let the lepers touch it or anything like that. They kept them back from the rope. And I was never afraid of leprosy anyway, because my boss, Mr. Lewis, used to have a leper that was his cook, see? And he thought nothing of it, and I was ate many meals there with him, see? And so that was not a problem. So during this these flying days down there, I was there until on May the 21st, 1927, Charles Lindbergh made a flight from New York to Paris, and that opened up a landslide of airplanes from all over the country. And of course, I had previously wanted to make that flight because of General Mitchell and I were talking about it one time. And so this gave me an opportunity probably to raise money for it. So I thought, well, I'll enter my name. But before I entered my name as a thing, I spent 3 sleepless nights. That, look, if I decide this thing, that I'm going to make this flight, then it's going to be done. Not just be pulled out of it or anything like this. So I finally decided, I'm going to do it. So I put up my name as an entry from Hawaii, and there was a couple other entries too, but they soon faded out of the picture. But I had enough courage to spend my own money to come back to the mainland. People down there didn't want to help out because they didn't want to contribute to my death. They all figured that was going to happen. So money was very difficult to get. But they got a group of people down there that would help with the funds if I would mortgage the airplane. And I thought, well, why not? If I don't get there, they don't get anything. And if I get there, they can have the airplane. Then, of course, toward the last, I needed more money, so they said, well, you have to mortgage the prize money if you get any. Okay, let's do that. So I mortgaged that. So this is the way that thing worked. And but there was very little coming from the public because they had been riding with me all this time in the past. And everything, I never even had a first landing down there. And I landed in some of the dullest places I've ever seen, see. And landed in baseball parks, and I've landed in going with the wind, going uphill. And so I could take off going downhill, see, against the wind. And so I never had any trouble. And so then, of course, when I left down there in June to come back to prepare for the flight, to try and get an airplane, that was the main thing. And when I got back to Los Angeles, of course, nobody had any airplane that would fly that distance and so on and so forth. And so I was now at Earl Doherty's place, and a man come through there that was flying that was entered in the dole race. Augie Peddler, his name. I'd known Augie Peddler quite a long time. So I was sort of disgusted because I couldn't get an airplane. He said, well, look, why don't you ride down with me down to San Diego? He said, I got to go down there to get my instruments worked over. And he says, Cy Canope is going to be my navigator, so Navy man, Navy lieutenant. So you come down with me, and he says, then maybe you'll find something down there. So I thought Orion. I thought maybe. So I went to Orion, and they had an airplane, and they let me take it, but the time was so short that I couldn't get it ready. So I said, no. So I turned it back to Orion and went headed for San Francisco. And we had to make application to the National Aeronautic Association 10 days before the flight, otherwise we're not eligible. So on the 10th day before the intended type now, the intended day, which was to be on the 12th of August, and just 10 days before that, August the 2nd, I was in Los Angeles on the way to San Francisco. I filed my application, and you had to give the size of the airplane, the horsepower of the engine, and this and that. And I didn't have an airplane, but I made all these. What I wanted was this size and this size and so on and
so
forth.
So you made up all that information?
So I made up this. And they, when I got to San Francisco, of course, I started inquiring around about the things, and everybody seemed to be gathering at Oakland because of the level field, and you didn't have any hills to cross. Because you could go out through the Golden Gate at the height of a wave if necessary, see. There's no bridges across in any place there, see. And they said, well, there's a former named Vance Brees here built an airplane for this flight, and he couldn't pay for it. So it was at a standstill now, see. And it had no fabric on it, didn't have any propeller, didn't have any wheels. As a matter of fact, just had didn't even have any wires built. But I was learning to splice wires in the Navy, see. So, boy, I got next to him, and we started working night and day. And I was splicing the cables, and I was helping with fabric and web stitching and everything you could think of. And, because that was duck soup to me anyway. And so we got the plane ready, just about ready. I was really carrying 5 gallon cans for gas because I didn't have time to build gas.
Gas tanks, just 5 gallon?
So they were going to carry 5 gallon cans and empty it into a container and then pump it up to the wing tanks. Well, the National Aeronautic Association were spearheading the thing, and they said, no, you can't do that. You've got to have a gas tank. Well, another thing, you can't fly alone. I was going to fly alone. I already had my course charted. Start out 248 degrees. Every 2 hours, change 1 degree to the left. 247, 246, 247, every 2 hours, and so on and so forth, a great circle course. So now they tell me, no, you got to have a navigator, because you can't do celestial observation.
Now, your ultimate destination was what?
What's that?
Your ultimate destination, where were you headed?
Hawaii.
Hawaii, okay.
Yeah. And so, anyway, this is in a dole race. Okay. From Oakland, California to Hawaii, or from any place in the mainland of the United States to Hawaii, see? And so everybody gathered in Oakland, though. And so after getting the bad word that I had to have a navigator, I advertised in the newspaper for a navigator that would go along, that I couldn't offer them any money because everything was tied up. And so I had many applicants. One of them was a girl that wanted to get in the movies. She was going to navigate me. And I said, do you know anything about navigation? I don't know anything, you know. So then, of course, the old lady was offered her services, and she didn't know, and the Boy Scout offered his services. And I says, well, do you know anything about navigation? Yeah. He says, I've been lost in the woods, and he says, find the way out with a compass. And that's his version of navigating, you see. And finally, a fellow did come up that was a navigator on a ship that had spent lots of time in Hawaii, in that area, navigating. And so then, of course, the examiner said, it sounds like that's the man. So I said, okay, come on up to the airport and I'll take you for a ride and see if you can take what I dish out. And I dished out plenty of promises. Mm-hmm. So, a lot of stunts, which I was criticized for, of course, for having instruments on there that, you know, was doing stunt flying, I think. But anyway, that soon faded off. So, and of course, we held a meeting. All the pilots got together. Nobody was ready. There wasn't a single one ready. So we all held a meeting in San Francisco, and we went to a hotel room, and everybody was present. And they said, well, what we're going to do is postpone it so these people can get their plane ready. So they postponed it 4 days, precisely 4 days. That means you start out, instead of 12:02, 2 minutes after 12, on the 12th, you start out 2 minutes after 12 on the 16th, see? And everybody signed it to him. So now, of course, anybody that willing to fly by themselves were not eligible for the prize money according to their signatures, see? Because they had to be ahead by 10 days of the flight. Here it was only 4 or 5 days ahead, see? So we had it all set. And so then, of course, there many things happened. And in the meantime, people were getting all kinds of tests made and here and there. And lots of them had never flown heavy loads, you know. And I flew a heavy load when I flew from San Diego to New York in the Jenny. You just don't pull it up. You've got to stay just, if it wants to touch the ground, you let it touch the ground, but you stay and get flight. So anyway, some of them there, one of the fellows who built an airplane with an Englishman that had built, Rogers was the name, and he was going to fly solo. He had two engines, one as a tractor, and then one behind him was a pusher. And of course, the wing that he had is apparently not very rigid, see, because as he was test flying it, he was applying aileron to come out of a turn. And as he applied aileron, it twisted the wing to pitch down so he got in a steeper turn. So he jumped parachute, see, and the parachute caught in the aft engine and wound up in the trigger, and here he was pulling in the back. So. And it crashed right in front of his wife. Then, of course, they had a case of Falbenema Wagner and Corval, the two Navy people were flying the Tremaine airplane. And they went down to, they were in San Diego to get their instruments all checked and everything like that. And then they filled up the gas and were heading for San Francisco or Oakland, rather. And it was foggy that morning, but there was about 100 feet below the fog. So they took off and went up into the fog like that, and they didn't get high enough to clear Point Loma. They went into the side of the hill, up in the gully, and burned up. So that is three people that are now demise. And so then, of course, they had some amateur pilots there that thought they knew how to fly, see? And lots of those there. And I won't say they're totally amateurs, because one of them was in the flying in the early days in First World War. But, you know, in those days, you'd raise the tail, and then you'd lower the tail in the air, and then you'd climb at about 30-degree angle. And when he took off, he tried to do the same thing with a heavily loaded airplane. And the result was that he'd come back to the ground. And of course, he didn't go into a spin or anything, because it had an airfoil on it that was quite stable in that respect. So then, of course, the other fellow, he was from San Diego, and he was taking off. And of course, instead of nosing forward, you know, getting the tail up off the ground, he was pulling back on it. He got a lot of pretty good speed, but not enough to take off, see. And he was pulling back, and he was digging his tail skid in the ground. All the time, and this also slows it up. And of course, when you do that, it gets unstable this way. And it got unstable, and the wing hit the ground, and the cartwheeled then, see. So now we've already got about eight people out of the thing, see. There's out of the 40-some paid entries to the National Aeronautic Association, only 15 were able to obtain airplanes. Out of the 15 airplanes, there was only eight that were qualified, that were told they were qualified. And out of the eight, there was only two that got there. And there was seven people lost at sea, and there's fiasco, of course. And a lot of people blame Dole for this sort of thing. But you never blame a man for that, because in my opinion, he did great service to aviation, because many things were found out during this flight. My navigator, of course, was a seafaring man. And being so, he did not know how to use an oxtant. So he had to use a sextant. A sextant is one that you must have a horizon and be able to see the star or the sun. And in our case, we had to fly within 100 feet of sea level while he was making these observations. So there was no point in going high to start with. So I thought, of course, that we started out in a fog, and of course, when it come to Farallon Islands, I was just slightly higher than the Farallon Island. And birds were scared off and everything from getting so close. But it was necessary to stay within 100 feet of sea level in order that he could make an observation. Because any time that you get higher than 100 feet, you get what they call dip. Dip is in the extra angle that is accumulated from flying high. And if you fly at 10,000 feet, goes 100,000 feet, we'll say, well, you'd probably be about 10 or 15 degrees difference. Because now the Earth is way down here, see? So you can't use that as a horizon. So we had to be within 100 feet of sea level. So we were started out at underneath the fog. And for 200 miles, instead of making changes, I thought he'd make changes every 2 hours. At the end of 2 hours, our ship was right smack ahead of us, sideways, and below the ship yet, up over it and back down to 100 feet again. And it went on that way until just before darkness set in. And then I was worried, plenty worried, because I had never flown blind. And I knew that this is very dangerous to be doing, to start climbing. I got to about 4,000 feet, and it got into a diving turn so fast that the struts were screaming going through the air. So I shut the engine off, and I pulled back on the controls and pushed the rudder so I knew which way I was going. Once I knew which way I was going, then I could straighten up, all right. So I straightened up, started climbing again. 7 minutes, any rhythm. So I got out of that and quick, because I knew just what was coming. So then I started climbing again. 7 minutes, I was doing another one. So I didn't have room enough for another one. So I decided, well, I'm going to try something. So I've got to do something different while I'm doing it, because I'm not working this way. So I held my rudder still, neutral, and the aircraft has a certain amount of stability to it, of course. So if I tip the airplane, it'll slide sideways, and that'll turn me because of the stabilizer. See? It'll cause me to turn. And when I get to turn to the right direction, then I can straighten up. Because then I got some feeling, see? And for about 5 or 6 hours at night, that was the longest night I've ever spent any place. And of course, about midnight or so, I was sort of relaxing and thinking I made it, because I could see a very faint horizon. So I relaxed, flying 100 feet according to the elevator. But I always had my hand on the throttle and the stick, just like that, always. I never took it off except to send a note. We had a little trolley that we sent notes to each other, see. And so anyway, I apparently hit the top of the wave. That's the only thing I could figure. Because all hell popped loose. And of course I was just like that. And it went shooting up in the air like this, and then of course I knew that I'd have to level off. So as I leveled off, I got a negative G. Things started flying up in the air, see. And the navigator had a telescope that he could make a landfall. And of course, in the morning he couldn't find it. So, but he did save his sextant. If that had gone, we'd have been in trouble. So anyway, we got noon. And he kept this course for 24 hours. So I wrote a note to him, said we should be within sight of the islands. And so he wrote a note back to me and said, circle and wait for high noon. We're already 24 hours out. Now I got a circle. And according to the Greenwich time, that would mean that we'd have to circle for 2.5 hours, which we did. Well, can't you take a shot on the sun? It's almost the top. And if you take that, and we can make up some of our distance, because I knew we were north of our course, because I had already previously intended to fly alone, had my course plotted. So he said, no, he couldn't do that. So I stalled the machine just before it would fall into the water, just high enough off the water I get some effect from lift. And I did this for 2.5 hours. And he made three shots then. I leveled off and got up about 50 feet so he could get the height of a deck. And he did three shots, averaged them out. He said, we're 200 miles north of our course. That means 2 hours more. So I had a due south then for 2 hours even. I turned, and within 5 minutes, I picked up the island of Oahu. Right smack on course for Wheeler Field. And so I wrote a note to him and said that he could sit down now because I recognized the island. I've been flying around it long enough to recognize it. So he said, for God's sake, don't do any stunts. He said, we're lucky to be here. And he said that again. And
so you came in second in the
race? So I came in second. And a friend of mine in New York, we were talking about this, and he says, you were in that dog race, weren't you? And I says, yeah. He says, well, how many was in it? He says, eight. He says, well, how did you come in? Second. Well, that's pretty good. That's really good. He says, then he says, well, how many finished? Two. What the hell do you mean? He said, you come in last. But I got second prize, $10,000 prize anyway.
$10,000.
But that went to the people that financed it, see. Both the airplane and the money, so I got nothing out of it. But the navigator, of course, was asked by the newspaper man, well, how much did you get? Nothing. Nothing. I said, how much did Jensen get? $10,000. And so the only thing I got, I got the check back after it's canceled, see. They got the money, the people that financed it, see. And of course, so he kept this up until they were writing stories about what a person this fellow Jensen was, see, to get all this money and not give him anything. So I borrowed $1,000 from a friend of mine, and I got $1,500 from a newspaper story, and I gave him $2,500. Mm-hmm. And I came out with about $15,000-$20,000 in the hole. That was all.
Was it worth it? Was it worth the trip?
Oh, yeah. I never object to that. No, anything I want to do, I'm willing to pay for it.
What did you do with the plane then? Leave it in Hawaii?
I left it there for the time being. But then the fellow down there decided that I didn't get a good square deal on it. So he decided he'd buy it, bring it to the mainland, and help me get converted into a passenger machine. And then I could do anything I wanted to with it. Just whenever I had any money, I could put it in the bank for him until it paid for.
So what did you do after the race then? After you won the race?
So that's a Lion flight.
Yeah. Let's hear about that.
And right after the race, I contracted with the Metro-Mail to carry the Leo the Lion from San Diego to New York, nonstop. And I had to fly over Albuquerque and circle Albuquerque. I had to fly over St. Louis and circle that, and then going in New York, and then I had a contract to carry the line from city to city as an advertisement. It was their Lion, Leo, that come out on the screen.
It was a special airplane, or?
Yeah, it was special built for the cage in it and everything, and I have a picture of it here to show you. And so anyway, they said they had to fly over Albuquerque, and this come to me out of the blue, because they didn't say that when I was in Hawaii, when I was contracted to carry this thing.
It's about a mile high there.
And besides, I didn't know whether it was a little lion or a big lion. But when I got up here, and they took me out to Metro-Mayor's lot, and Mr. Mayor, and they had a bunch of movie stars there witnessing the getting acquainted thing, sort of, see? And so they said, here, you put this milk in that tray for the lion, see? Okay, so I stood just as far away as I could, reaching them. So they said, "All right, well, do that over again. You registered flight," and I sure did, believe me. So they said, "Take the pan out and put it back in the bottle and feed it to them again." So I started to pull the pan out, and the lion hit that pan, and it flew milk all over the place. See? And I said, "Now I was scared." So then, of course, I told him, I said, "Look, you can't go over Albuquerque. You can't get that high with this machine. You're overloaded now. You've got 400 pounds of plate glass on it, so they can photograph straight through the lion, for the lion. You got 400 pounds of lion. You've got 300 and some gallons of fuel at 6 pounds per gallon. Mm-hmm. So you're just overloaded, you can't make it." "Oh, our engineers figured they can." I said, "Yeah, but they're not flying the airplane."